You're listening to WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
Check, check, one, two. Look like a little country. Rock and roll and blues. Cause we sure love playing for good people like you. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two.
You are listening to Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, the radio show that features conversations with and the music of local musicians and traveling musicians performing in town. I'm your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I'm talking with Darko Budorak, guest conductor of the Savannah Philharmonic, for performances on Saturday, February 7th at both 3 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. at the Lucas Theater for the Arts. In this program entitled Beethoven's Eroica, they will be performing Mozart's Overture to the Marriage of Figaro, Saint-Saëns' Cello Concerto No. 1 in A minor, Opus 3, and the show will conclude, of course, with Beethoven's Symphony No. 3 in E flat major, Opus 55, Eroica. Joining Maestro Darko Budorak will be cellist William Soot. He'll be performing Saint-Saëns' Cello Concerto No. 1 in A minor, Opus 3. Welcome to Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, Darko Budorak.
Thank you so much, Dave.
So let's get to know Darko Budorak. Tell me your musical journey.
Well, I currently serve as the music director of the Asheville Symphony in North Carolina. Originally, I come from Belgrade, Serbia, by the way of Seattle, Washington, where I grew up. I went to school at the University of Toronto, followed by Indiana University for grad school, followed by posts in Flagstaff, Arizona, Missoula, Montana, Tallahassee, Florida, and as I mentioned earlier, Asheville, North Carolina.
Early on, most young musicians don't start as conductors. They start as instrumentalists. Did you do that?
I actually decided that I would pursue conducting at the age of 17. I was a bit of an outlier in that way. But I did make sure to get my instrumental chops to the best of my ability, which is why I did a degree in cello performance. And only then did I proceed to go on to conducting studies during my master's and later years.
So your first degree then at the University of Toronto was in cello performance.
Indeed.
And hence, we'll be talking about a cello work later on.
Yeah, and one of my favorites, actually.
You had conducting in mind early on, as you said, at the age of 17. How did you come across the idea of being a conductor at 17?
Well, I was very fortunate to be in an exceptional high school music program. This was out in Seattle at Garfield High School. We didn't have one, not two, but three orchestras in the school. It was a very special place. Throughout my 4 years, we performed works of the standard repertoire, much like a big youth orchestra would. And so as a senior project, I had an opportunity to work on the first movement of Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony, to conduct it in performance. And that's the first time I had a performance in public. And I loved it from the very first moment I stepped up on the podium. I fell in love with it, and I said, this speaks to me. This is something that resonates with me. This is my passion. This is what I want to pursue for the rest of my life. And here I am a few years later.
Well, that's quite a movement, because basically cello is a single line of music at any particular time. Yes, double stops and some other ways to bring other voices in. I mean, like, you can be pizzicatoing with the left hand, bowing with the right, things like that.
Right.
So there are ways to bring other voices in, but an orchestra is a whole bunch of people.
Exactly.
And so that movement from thinking of a single line, and even with your bachelor's degree being really thinking through a single line of music, to a whole group of individuals and their music, how did you make that conversion?
I think just, you know, as anybody else basically not playing a keyboard instrument in my industry does, which is through study of harmony, study of theory, and learning to think vertically. It's not something that comes easily to me, but I still will, when I study scores, I will take the time to play the harmonies on the piano to really integrate that vertical structure of the orchestra. But the aspect of line is very important as well. My colleagues who are pianists often struggle with the idea of the long line in the phrase. So I think all of us as conductors, we really have to explore this tension, where our ear is going during performance. Is it based on vertical or on horizontal thinking? And both are necessary, and you kind of switch between both depending on what the music calls for during conducting.
That idea of the vertical as well as the horizontal. Now, were you introduced to music theory as part of your high school experience?
No, not at a serious level. That really came during undergrad, and I fell in love with it. I mean, I'm kind of an analytical person, and so for me, the beauty of music is found as much in that harmonic world as it is in simply listening or enjoying the line or the sweep of the music. For me, the way I approach scores actually is to start with the harmonic. Maybe this is a part of being a cellist. Maybe this is the advantage because you come from a perspective of being a single line instrument. For me, it always felt like knowing the vertical side is something that did not come to me naturally. And so a lot of my focus and study is specifically on that. And I view harmony in any piece of music. Harmonic structure for me is a way to determine character, to determine how a drama in a work unfolds is through harmony. As the harmony changes, the character has to change. And for me, that is the key to creating compelling performances. Not to get too nerdy right off the bat, but you brought up a very interesting question.
And then, so you, as part of your master's degree, you moved at Indiana, you moved on to conducting. And who are your mentors there in Indiana?
Two opera conductors, David Efron and Imre Palo. Indiana University is a great opera school. It presents eight productions annually, which is incredible. And so it wasn't just introduction to conducting. I've done some work in my undergrad years as well, but it was an introduction to basically a whole new art form. And so that really formed me in my approach to music making, in my love of opera, my love of singing. And those are lessons that still apply in symphonic music as well. They're so interconnected. We always talk about opera being influential to the symphonic world, but it's not always taught like that at conservatories. They're kept kind of separate. And the great advantage of being in Indiana was seeing how important opera is to understand the symphony and vice versa.
Yeah, that's a very interesting approach. And you are the music director at Asheville and the Asheville Symphony and the conductor there. You have had some experiences, of course, before becoming the conductor there at Asheville. Were many of your experiences operatic? Have you had a lot of operatic experience?
Certainly not a large amount. I think the majority of my work in my career is entirely symphonic, but I have pursued it. I've continued to pursue it through the years. And every year or two, an opportunity comes to do something operatic, whether it's a full production or a concert version. But I've been in it maybe more than most of my colleagues. And I love going to the opera. I have the fortune of going to the Metropolitan Opera on a fairly regular basis. I continue to nurture the love of that form. And in fact, I think we can even talk about this program through that lens. We start with an operatic overture, but then we have two pieces that, in a way, are very dramatic. And I think it's curious with two composers who really didn't work in the theater, in the case of Saint-Saëns and Beethoven, how they approach drama. And in a sense, how much of their language comes from an operatic background, however loosely.
Well, you are in love with opera and you're in love with singing, but you're
Yes.
also in love with a singer.
That's true. I'm married to a wonderful singer who Savannah audiences know very well, Mickey Södergren. She's the executive director of the American Traditions Vocal Collection, familiarly known as the ATC. And we had an opportunity to meet through music and are making a beautiful life together.
And I mean, she has a very complicated life, as you have a very complicated life, because she is also in the chorus of the Metropolitan Opera, which is a
Exactly.
very demanding role throughout the fall and spring. But also, fortunately, the Metropolitan Opera goes on break in February, so that she has a chance then to spend some time here in February with us.
That's true.
And I know that because we broadcast the Metropolitan Opera on WRUU. And so we divide the responsibilities. The automated part is done by another member of the staff, and but all the pre-recorded ones I do. So
Oh, lovely.
I'm very busy in February. This program that we're bringing here to Savannah was changed. My understanding was there was originally a world premiere scheduled for this particular performance.
Correct. And to my knowledge, the premiere could not take place in time. The piece would not be ready in time, and this is why the program was changed earlier this fall.
Now, the program itself is a concert of what I refer to as DWEM, Dead White European Males.
Yes, very much.
And
Meat and
there's,
potatoes kind of super hits.
right, exactly. But there's so much more than DWEM in this world of music. And so, what's your feelings about incorporating women composers, incorporating composers who are living and breathing, for instance? Certainly more 20th century music and 21st century music in programs.
I do it all the time. My approach to programming is that we have, good 300 years plus of repertoire that we can present at the Symphony Hall. And as such, my approach overall is to look for variety. So I love mixing pieces from different eras. I love mixing pieces from different places. I'm generally not a fan of the German program, the French program, the Czech program, the Russian program. It has its place once, twice a season. I enjoy doing that just like anybody else. But I think, especially in the last 10 years, with the audience being curious, more curious about different types of music and different composers, it's opened up a great opportunity for music directors to create programs that can be a little bit more adventurous, be a little bit crazier. And the audience will go with the narrative. If the programming is good and the piece fits in, is not just tacked on, then I think it can make for very compelling evening of music at the hall. Last time I was in Savannah, we had a concert with Brahms' Second Symphony, and on the first half, we featured the work by William Grant Still, his Panama Dances. But then I offered, as the opening of the concert, an overture from, I believe, 1901 musical in Dahomey, which was the first Broadway musical composed, created, written, performed by all Black musicians. And it was a really neat thing, kind of, to bring that as a pairing with the William Grant Still for that concert. So I'm a curious person. I like to discover new repertoire, and my programs tend to be a little more varied than what we're presenting this month. But as I said, this is such a fantastic program. I feel very fortunate to bring this to our audiences in Savannah.
Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I'm talking with Darko Budorac, guest conductor of the Savannah Philharmonic. It's become a tradition in many orchestras over the last decade. Well, you can tell I'm chronologically challenged, so when I say decade, that probably means 20 or 30 years. But relatively recently, it's become quite common here in Savannah, as well as I've seen other orchestras, including the Asheville Symphony, to include concerts of non-classical music?
Yeah. My motto, I love the Duke Ellington quote. I repeat it all the time everywhere I go. There's two types of music, great music and not. So it doesn't matter what the genre is. It matters what the work is. It matters how it's performed. And I personally take great pride to approach any genre of music with the same commitment. We have an entire series in Asheville which is devoted to basically genres outside of the concert hall that are expected in the concert hall. So, and in fact, we use a lot of ATC singers for that series. And that has been incredibly successful. It's been driving a lot of philanthropy, a lot of audience engagement, and it's entirely based on more or less 20th, 21st century American music. That's the crux of it. And it's been a great learning opportunity for me because it's not something that I was trained in when I was in conservatory. We certainly focused. What was your acronym again for Dead White Guys?
Oh, DWEM,
DWEMs, yes.
DWEM.
Yes. That was certainly the core of my study when I was younger. And so I think it's great. I think by reaching out to different styles as musicians, we can really grow as musicians. It only makes us better to challenge how we think of music, how we think of different elements of music, how they create a style. Those are really powerful questions to think about. And then take something from one experience and bring it to the other, and vice versa.
Well, to give you an idea of my biases, I do have a show called 4 Centuries of Great Music, which is covering the full realm of classical music, from mostly the beginning in maybe the 17th century, but really mostly the 18th century, 19th century, 20th century. And that's a straight music program. Because for the 21st century, I have a conversation program like this one, called Contemporary Classics, where I talk to pretty much exclusively 21st century composers, performers who are performing 21st century works across the gamut. Because unlike periods in the past, today it's very acceptable to compose in a variety of styles as you're working. You can have neo-romantic new compositions. You can have new compositions that set certainly the Savannah audience on edge. I like new explorations in sound. So that's one of the reasons I love this show, the 21st century music. But it set a lot of people in Savannah on edge because this is a very conservative environment musically. And then a third show called Evening Eclectic, which is everything else I like, which tends to focus more on jazz. But I'll have pop singers, singer-songwriters, I'll have bluegrass, I'll have a variety of other things on that show. And that's also a conversation show like this one. So, hence my inclusion of a lot of a whole show that is heavily DWEM, but also includes music from the 20th century and 19th century, much less on the 18th century of, say, women composers. Now, this concert coming up, it is a remarkable set of three pieces that are very diverse, but as you said, very, very singing. So
Yes.
we could sort of put singing as sort of an emphasis on this, although there's never a single human voice involved. We start off with Mozart's Overture to Marriage of Figaro, which of course is an opera overture, and this is really the perfect opera buffo opening, which Mozart was so skilled at, with a very quiet opening and then a boisterous playing of the themes throughout the rest of the work.
Yeah, I think it's why this piece is so incredible is that it gives you the spirit of the opera without directly being related to the opera. So immediately you hear, the strings and the bassoon at the beginning, and it's very quick, very meandering, rustling. There's a nervous energy right at the beginning, and it's maintained, and suddenly it bursts back into a D major forte across the orchestra. So in other words, it's like the quick thinking element of the story. And for listeners who may not be familiar, Marriage of Figaro is entirely a story where the servants come into conflict with their noble superiors. And the marriage in question is between two servants, Figaro and Susanna. And the count, who is the head of the household, is trying to make his inroads with Susanna. And so there's a bunch of side plots involved, but it's all about scheming. There's great opportunities for humor, but there is also kind of the person who's from the lower social caste is outwitting the master. And all of this is presented within the overture. The second theme is very much, let's say, in the spirit of the music of love between the to be married couple, between Susanna and Figaro. And then in a way you have the affirmation, you know, the big drums and the trumpets can play, and the piece ends in D major. And it finishes with really a big bang. It's the perfect opera overture, especially for the time period.
Thank you.
I do find it fascinating, though, to have this Marriage of Figaro overture on paired with Eroica, because between 1786, when Mozart's Marriage of Figaro was composed, and 1805, when Eroica premieres, written in 1803, 1804, but 1805 is the premiere. In those basically 20 years, the world changes, and it still has remained changed up until to this day because of the revolutions. We can count the American Revolution as being part of that movement in 1776, but especially in Europe, the French Revolution. And so, in a way, Mozart's overture is a little tight, compressed piece, which gives you the impact of the drama of the entire opera in some 4 minutes of music. And it secures you. It says, yes, this will happen, and this is how it's supposed to happen. And in a way, I will not challenge you. I will entertain you. And here's the piece. And of course, what happens because of the revolution, Vienna and the Habsburg Empire go through kind of a social economic upheaval. Beethoven comes to the scene, and here's a composer on the second half of the program who gives you the most challenging work ever created in the history of the world at that time. So the aesthetic is completely different. You couldn't have more different pieces in terms of their intent. One securing you, one guaranteeing entertainment, the other one saying, I will shake you to your entire philosophical core on the second half and present the longest piece of symphonic music ever conceived on a scale twice as big as anything ever existed in a symphony and will change the symphonic world forever 20 years later, basically. And then in the middle, we have Saint-Saëns that is, in a sense, an outlier by being a romantic piece from 1872, but in and itself is a kind of a reaction to the two pieces, looking for a French voice between these two Germanic Austrian heavyweights.
This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
You're listening to WRUU, your local radio station, for people just like you, hosted by people from your community. The voices you hear are your neighbors, coworkers, and others from the Savannah and Lowcountry area. In other words, WRUU is your community radio station. Please help us by donating whatever you can to help your neighbors and friends stay on the air. Go to WRUU.org and support your local radio station. Any amount is welcomed. Thank you for your support of WRUU.
This portion of WRUU's programming is brought to you by listeners like you and by the American Traditions Collection of Concerts, including the American Traditions Competition Week, featuring 24 of the top singers from around the country from February 16th to the 20th in quarterfinals, semifinals, and finals competitive rounds at Victory North, 2603 Whitaker Street, Savannah. More information and tickets are available at www.atcsavannah.org. This music is often called classical music, but remember, Mozart, Beethoven, and Liszt were the rock stars of their time, so I simply call it great music. I'm your host, Dave Lake, and join me for four centuries of great music, with new episodes each week on Sundays from 3 to 5 p.m. We also have encores of these episodes on Saturdays from 3 to 5 p.m. from mid-June to early December. Welcome back to Music Local and Sustainable, and I'm your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I'm talking with Darko Budorak, guest conductor of the Savannah Philharmonic, for performances on Saturday, February 7th at both 3 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. at the Lucas Theater for the Arts. In this program entitled Beethoven's Eroica, they will be performing Mozart's overture to The Marriage of Figaro, Saint-Saëns' Cello Concerto No. 1 in A minor, Opus 3. And the show will conclude, of course, with Beethoven's Symphony No. 3 in E flat major, Opus 55, Eroica. Joining Maestro Darko Budarek will be cellist William Soot. He'll be performing Sesson's Cello Concerto No. 1 in A minor, Opus 3. The Sesson Cello Concerto No. 1 in A minor, Opus 3. This in itself is quite unique. Speaking to a cellist, I'll compare it to the Dvorak Cello Concerto. The Dvorak Cello Concerto has one of the longest orchestral openings before we hear the cello. Here, we have one chord of orchestral opening, and then we hear the cello.
Yes. Well, the reason Saint-Saëns is, and this is not a piece I chose for the program. I think we just got lucky because, you know, the soloist was already set. In case of the Saint-Saëns, why this is an interesting piece is this is written in 1872 in Paris. In 1870, the Germans came and went all the way into Paris and destroyed the Second Republic. And you had the French Commune and like complete destruction of society. So Saint-Saëns is writing a piece that's looking for a French voice to be distinct from the Germanic approach to music making. And so we can look at this entire piece and we can say, how is this reacting to what the expectation of the Central European axis, you know, the German Viennese way of writing concertos is? So you can look at, I know maybe Mendelssohn Violin Concerto could be a model, Beethoven Violin Concerto could be a model. Those are pieces that we're now moving away from. Certainly away from Wagner, anything to do with Wagner or Brahms. This is supposed to be entirely different. So the aesthetic of the piece, the Cello Concerto, is 20 minutes long. It certainly is not created to create tension through length, like Beethoven would do it. As you mentioned, there's no long introduction. There, it's just, boom, go. Immediately. There's a lightness to the piece. There's a chamber music quality to the piece. The way the woodwinds are used is almost in conversation with the cello instead of just being a harmonic background to give color. It really becomes a conversation element. They're almost like a Greek chorus at times with the soloist. There's a transparency to the structure. We already mentioned how the middle part of the piece, you can basically look at the piece as being in three movements that are joined together. The middle part goes back. It's like a form of neoclassicism before Prokofiev and Stravinsky were cool. So we have this minuet. There's an element of lightness in it all. And the entire prism can be, how can we make this different from a Germanic expectation?
I love that. He went back into the classical period of music before Stravinsky and Prokofiev made it cool to do that.
Yeah. That's also interesting. You know, this is a time, the second half of the 19th century is when people really, this is where how we program music changes. By the end of the 19th century, we're fully in recycle mode of old composers, of bringing them back. Like, it's expected to have a work from a previous time. So the aesthetic is changing already. So as a result of being surrounded by old music, maybe it's no wonder that Saint-Saëns is inspired to go back and look for something different in the past to counteract the German scherzo. That would be expected as the dance element in a symphonic work.
The first movement, too, I love the way that he introduces the idea of counter melodies, you know, flow between the orchestra and the soloist at times, and sort of into the a very playful call and answer sort of structure.
Yes. In the entire concerto, nothing is really segregated. Like, the orchestra plays something and then the soloist plays the exact same thing. That really is a rare occurrence. Almost always there's an interaction. Even at the very beginning, as you said, yes, the cello starts with the melody, but before that you have the slap of the orchestra. It's almost as the orchestra says, go, launch forth, and then the melody begins. So there's always this like there is an interplay throughout. It's never quite the orchestra lays down a carpet and a cello just sings on top. There is always some interjection, some reflection, even a little phrase at the end of the phrase might be saying, aha, that's what you mean to say. And the aesthetic of the piece is that it moves forward. It's supposed to be organic. It's supposed to feel like one idea from beginning to end, not a segmented work. And so even especially in the if you can look at the first part of the concerto as being a loose type of sonata form, you can look at the second part, as we talked about, an antique minuet. And then the third part is a rondo, meaning alternation of themes, but the alternation of themes brings back the idea from the first movement. So the whole thing is cyclical, maybe like how Liszt would have done it. So there is an integration in the piece. It's a very original form that Saint-Saëns creates. Again, he's trying to create a new French music, so it makes sense. The writing for the cello is fantastic. One of the challenges of writing for the cello is for the instrument to be heard. It sits in the lower register, and especially the middle strings of the cello have a hard time projecting across the entire orchestra. And so Saint-Saëns is very judicious about writing music for the upper and lower register versus the middle register and how he chooses to accompany said moments. So certainly he was an incredible musician and was really knew the instrument well. It's very idiomatic to play this piece.
This thing is just filled with new themes. It's short, and the first movement is relatively short, but I think it has like four different themes in the first movement.
More. Yes, you're absolutely right. Saint-Saëns also, he had a phenomenal gift for melody. He worked as an organist. He was a prodigy keyboard player and worked in at La Madeleine, one of the most prestigious positions for an organist in the entire world in Paris. And of course, to do that, you had to be an incredible improviser. And I think those skills were just unbelievable. Same like Mozart. He's basically like a French Mozart, 80 years removed.
And he isn't done with the themes because the themes, again, it other than themes in the second movement. And the second movement also is the part that contains the cello cadenza, which is typical of a concerto. And then the third movement, he goes back to some of the themes from the first movement, and but then introduces additional themes.
Yes, third movement is the place for kind of a more dramatic moment to take place. We didn't talk about the key. The key is written in A minor. So, being a minor key, it starts dark and stormy. The middle part goes to F major. So, it's again, it's lighter. It fits this character of the minuet. And then we go back towards the world of A minor and again, darkness, but this time we have the heroic ending. It switches towards A major at the end, and in a way, Saint-Saëns goes back to the aesthetic of Mozart of pleasing us at the end of the piece, so kind of giving us a grounded ending without too much struggle, without the Beethovenian drama, which is intentional. There, the aspect of lightness is intentional to the piece, again, to contrast the hegemony of dramatic music at the time.
Yeah, because in the third movement, which is tempo primo, the first tempo at the beginning of the work, and he restates the opening theme, but then he isn't done yet. He throws one more little theme in right at the end.
Yeah.
Something brand new.
Yeah, he had the Saint-Saëns had, as we said, he had a phenomenal gift of gab.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Darko, we haven't even had a chance to talk about the Eroica Symphony yet. Well, we won't have a show before the concert coming up, but we're going to have to get back together after the concert and talk about the Eroica Symphony.
Fantastic.
Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I've been talking with Darko Budorak, guest conductor at the Savannah Philharmonic Performances on Saturday, February 7th, both at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m., and at the Lucas Theater for the Arts, and joining Maestro Darko Budorak in this program called Beethoven's Eroica will be cellist William Sue, and they'll be performing the Saint-Saëns Cello Concerto No. 1 in A minor, Opus 3, which we just talked about. But also, the program opens with Mozart's Overture to the Marriage of Figaro. And of course, is the Beethoven Symphony No. 3 in E flat major, Opus 55, Eroica, completes the entire program. And Darko, I want to thank you so very much for being on the show tonight.
Thank you so much, Dave. I really appreciate it. It's been really fun talking to you.